Welcome, everybody. We'll get started. It's good to see you all. I understand that I have Don's class again. Last time, I think I did not successfully steal very many people from it, and so I'll make another attempt tonight to peel people off of his class. Let me just say this. He's a fine teacher. but he does not appreciate you like I do, I promise you. I truly, truly want you here. So just think about that when you walk in the door next time. Anyway, I'm glad you're here. And we are, I was asked who will be studying tonight. And I said, tonight's a little bit of a downer in that we are going to study Judas Iscariot. In fact, we're going to study all of the Judas disciples tonight to differing degrees. And so we want to talk about Judas a little bit tonight. And so I will say there's a lot of really good insight, a lot of really interesting insight when we study Judas, and so we'll do that tonight. Let's bow and pray, and then we'll begin. Our Father in heaven, we're thankful to you for this time we have to be together. We're thankful for your church. We're thankful that you have given us this time to encourage each other and to honor you, to bear one another's burdens, and at this time to study your word and to understand it. We ask that you would help us to be motivated to live lives of service, that we would always be looking for good to do. And we're thankful to you more than anything for your Son, Jesus Christ. We're thankful for his sacrifice. We're thankful that you show us grace and mercy. And we pray all these things in his name. And amen. So as a reminder, we've studied five disciples so far in this class. First, we talked about Andrew. And what is it that we said was important? What did we want to remember about Andrew? What did he do? He sought the Messiah, and then what did he do? Told people about it. He told everybody he could that he found the Messiah. And that's some really good stories about Andrew. We talked about Peter. And what are some things, what are some basic things that we know about Peter from that study? And you know what? I think that's kind of how I want to say it. He just tried really hard, and he kept trying and dedicated himself to Christ, even through mistakes and challenges. And so Peter just kept trying. We talked about Mary Magdalene a little bit, and we talked specifically about the group of women that were fearlessly loyal to Christ, that they followed Christ, and even though they were in danger, just like everyone, they were loyal to him, even when others ran off. We talked about Matthew. And we talked about the fact that he was a person that was despised in that society. People talked about him in the same breath as just the dregs of society. But he still followed Christ and dedicated himself to Christ. And then, of course, we talked about John the Baptist. And the things I'd like you to remember about John the Baptist is what he wanted you to remember. First of all, the thing he said almost as much as anything, which is, I am not the Christ. So when we think about John the Baptist, he was not the Christ. He was there to point to the Christ. He was there to prepare the way, to turn people back to God. And I want to remember, he was not the Christ. His job was to decrease, and Christ was to increase. And so those are some of the people we've studied already. I do want to talk tonight a little bit about Judas. And let's take 30 seconds and talk about the other Judas. We also know there was Judas. If we look in Acts 6, we see that there's this description in verse 12. I'm sorry, it's Luke 6. I know I typoed in my notes. It's Luke 6, where it says in verse 12, now it was at this time that he went off to the mountain to pray, and he spent the whole night in prayer to God. And when day came, he called his disciples to him and chose 12 of them, whom he named as apostles, Simon, whom he also named Peter, and his brother Andrew, and James, and John, and Philip, and Bartholomew, and Matthew, and Thomas, James the son of Alphaeus, and Simon, who was called the Zealot, Judas the son of James, and Judas Iscariot, who became a traitor. And so we'll just touch on the fact that there was someone here that named Judas the son of James, also known as, if you sing the song, who is Judas in that one? Thaddeus is who some refer to this Judas as. I've read some. I don't know that I agree with it, but there are some who say that this Judas also called Thaddeus, was the one who wrote Jude, but I don't know that I agree with that. I don't know if anybody in here has any great insight to it, but I've read that, and I don't know that I believe it or not. So we'll start here. So that was Judas, son of James. So let's talk about Judas Iscariot now for the rest of our time. This says the very definition of Judas. He's named, Jesus prayed and made this extremely important decision, this much gravity as you could have on a decision, and he prayed about it, and he chose these people. And then the last in the list, it says Judas Iscariot, who became a traitor. And it's going to be very interesting, I think, as we go through this. I can tell you one of the biggest challenges in preparing for this class tonight was trying to get all of the different accounts, the gospel accounts, in some order and try to find the details. I don't know if you've ever done that before, where you see that it's the same thing with Peter, where there's details in every gospel and in all these places and trying to put them together. And so one of the things we're going to try to do is go through this in some logical order to see the story of Judas Iscariot. Before we go there, I want to just talk generally for a minute and ask about the concept of betrayal. It's a word that I think is pretty, it's a strong word, and certainly one that I think we use, but if I was to ask you, what is betrayal, how would you describe that? Or what does it mean to be betrayed? Any thoughts? What's that? Forgo a trust. So I think I'm glad you brought that word up already. There is this foregoing of trust, a person who is trusted and it's broken. The trust is broken. Any other ways you would talk about what betrayal is? Betrayal is a word, and we're going to get into, when we talk about this word and see what Judas did, we're going to talk a little bit about how strong a word that is. Betrayal has to do with siding with the enemy. Betrayal is being in a trusting relationship, and instead of defending the one that you're in that relationship with, that you have this trusting relationship with, you instead side with the enemy in an attack. In fact, the term used here, that I don't know what your version says, but in Luke 6 says he became a traitor. That definitely brings in this more of this idea of a country. What do we call it whenever a person in the United States turns against their country and sides with the enemy? What's that called? Yeah, a traitor. It is called treason. What is the punishment for treason? It is death. Still, in the United States of America in 2021, a person who commits an act of treason, it is the death penalty. And that treason and becoming a traitor has to do with being a citizen, being in a loyal, trusting relationship as a citizen of a country, and I instead turn to the enemy and I help the enemy do damage. Already you can see how those definitions make sense in the life of Judas Iscariot. So here's some other questions about that. Why is it that betrayal is so painful? Why is it that when a person is betrayed, it is so painful to them? Okay, I thought more of you. I thought that you were going to treat me good and instead you treated me bad. Other ways? What's that? The breaking of trust is a very painful thing. And so whenever a person trust a person and instead they attack, and when we say trust here, I want to make sure we're talking about this idea about safety. It has to do with this trust is I'm in this position of safety, and instead of safety, I get attack. That is why betrayal is so painful. Go ahead, Tammy. Yes. Yes, you can't undo the damage. And so she said there's damage that's done. It's not just a whoops. It's not just, this is not the kind of thing that's just a mistake that's made and an apology is made. This is damage that's done. Ray, were you going to say something? It's hard to get it back. Yeah, it's hard to unshoot that gun. And so that damage is done. So here's another question. Why is betrayal so effective? If you talk about a traitor or a person who commits treason or a person who betrays to help another, why is it effective? Okay, so one thing she said is, I'm going to do hers first. was a Jew? I'm sorry. Say it again. Insight. This person has, it is effective because they know you. And they know how to do damage. And of course, we, once again, this you can already see the relationship to what Judas Iscariot did. Mr. Adams? Yes, and so the idea, look, how preposterous is that someone who is protecting you instead stabbing? And so that's why betrayal is effective, because it is a person who has lulled you into this sense of security and instead does harm. Jim, were you going to say something? Did I miss you? Jim King? Oh, I didn't see that. Okay, go ahead, Bruce. So Bruce says, you make yourself vulnerable to a person in those relationships. And when you open that up, you have made yourself, you have opened up weakness there. And so we're going to give Bruce the credit for vulnerability, for introducing the concept of vulnerability to us. Just Andy on Wednesday night was talking about how there's a good side to vulnerability too. That as Christians, we should be vulnerable with each other. We should be bearing one another's burdens and confessing sins. And that relationship, it is something that opens us up to a weakness. Yes, sir. Yeah. Yeah, and so we see with Judas Iscariot, we see that there was this relationship that he had that was so deep that it allowed for a very deep betrayal. And I will say, and I guess the next question is, why does it happen? What? And so I don't want to answer that right now. I want to ask that question. I want to think about it as we go through Judas Iscariot. Why does it happen? In the case of Judas Iscariot, that's the big question for this study, is to say, why did Judas do this? There's a lot of interesting questions. I mean, you know them all. There's the question of why did Judas do this? Was he ever a loyal apostle? Did Jesus know when he picked him? There's some of these philosophical questions that there may be no answer to, but they're very interesting. But I'll tell you that this concept, as we go through here, I want us to think about that as we see what Judas did and how dastardly some of the things he did were. I have experienced some pretty major betrayals in my life. I'll tell you one story of one. It was actually right after I was married. I was getting on a plane to go on my honeymoon. And I'll just tell you already, it was Missy who committed this treachery. So I was married, excellent wedding, and we went and got on a plane to go to California for our honeymoon. First class, thanks to my parents. And got in first class, and it was great. I pretty immediately fell asleep. Fell very hard asleep. And I woke up, and you know, you're kind of groggy on the plane, and I woke up and sat there for a minute, and then I noticed that everyone was feasting on Andy's mints, on little mints. And I thought, oh, that's neat. And I looked around, and I was like, I don't know where my mint is. And I said, Missy, what happened to my mint? And as I looked over to her, I saw this. And she wouldn't look at me. And I kept asking, and she said, I think they can give us another one. And so the first act of Missy and our marriage was to steal my mint on the plane on the way to California. Now, I will admit that I had already betrayed her so many times because of all of the lies I told before we were married about the things I like to do. And she thought I loved running and going to the beach and reading and quiet moments. And so that was all just... She thought before we were married that I would just relish the opportunity to go on a nature hike. But post-marriage, she came to the realization. And by the way, and over our marriage, the best sign that our marriage has grown is that our AC is now at 72 degrees, which is a great victory for me. So, back to Judas Iscariot. I wanted to talk about the concept of betrayal and the concept of being a traitor, because I want us to look at it in this perspective of what type of a relationship Judas had with Jesus, opportunity he had. Maybe we'll talk a little bit about motive and those things, but the goal here is to see what did he do, why did he do it, and why was it so effective? Why was it so powerful? And I want to start with the story in John 12, and we're going to just do it, start in John 12. We're going to be going to Matthew 26 as well. Yeah, get your page-turning fingers ready, because we're going to have to go back and forth quite a bit here, but we're going to start in John 12. And this is a story you know pretty well, but this is where I think it's, we're, and I should tell you, we're going to jump around a little bit. We're going to have to go back and see a little bit about the stories of what people thought of Judas, what Jesus thought of Judas. In fact, I should mention that in John 6, when Jesus talks about choosing his disciples, he talks about that he has his disciples, but he says, and one of them is a devil. One of you is a devil, he says, and even says in the subtext there that he was referring to Judas Iscariot. So there is this theme, there is this, but I think we have to look at this almost like starting with the mindset of the disciples at this time, not knowing that he was a traitor. Even when Luke wrote it, when John wrote it, at the time that they experienced it, they didn't know. And so in John 12, we just see a little evidence about Judas Iscariot. And so in verse 1, therefore 6 days before the Passover, Jesus came to Bethany where Lazarus was, whom Jesus had raised from the dead. So they made him a dinner there, and Martha was serving, and Lazarus was one of those reclining at the table with him. Mary then took a pound of very expensive perfume of pure nard and anointed the feet of Jesus and wiped his feet with her hair, and the house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. I want to stop there before we even get to Judas Iscariot. But you know this story, that they're all there reclining, they're all there relaxing, and it says that Mary then came and took a pound of expensive perfume and started to anoint his feet. I want to make sure we understand the degree to which she was giving him honor. This, first of all, I want you to think about how much a pound is of something. I don't know if you've ever held a pound of something, but like when you go to the store and you get a pound of ground beef, that's a big chunk. And you have to think about that this was a very expensive perfume. There have been estimates. It says, in fact, if you go to, we won't turn there now, but it says that it was worth 300 denarii. That's how expensive and valuable this nard was, this perfume. That conceivably was $25,000 worth of perfume. This is and you just have to think about the moment where he's there relaxing and she goes and grabs this giant thing of perfume and starts anointing him with it, a giant amount, worth tens of thousands of dollars, and putting it on him, which we'll see in a minute, Jesus felt like wasn't crazy. Now, what about Judas and the other disciples? So let's look here in verse 4. But Judas Iscariot, one of his disciples, the one who intended to betray him, said, "Why is this perfume not sold for 300 denarii and the proceeds given to poor people?" Now he said this not because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief. And as he kept the money box, he used to steal from what was put into it. Therefore Jesus said, "Leave her alone so that she may keep it for the day of my burial. For you always have the poor with you, but you do not always have me." We're going to talk about that a little more in a moment. But you see Judas's reaction, and this is one of those verses where we don't have to do a lot of deep interpretation because it is explained to us exactly what's going on here. She is doing this extremely humble act. We already talked about how humble it is to wash feet, and she is washing it with this thousands and thousands of dollars worth of perfume. And Judas's reaction is, hey, this is a lot of money we're dealing with here. We should take this instead, sell it, and take all this money and give it to the poor. Now, we don't have to know whether he was sincere or not, because it tells us he was not. It says he didn't care anything about the poor. He was trying to manipulate the situation because he wanted as much valuable stuff as possible in the money box. He wanted to put as much into the money bag that he had control over as possible so that he could pilfer out of it. And so this already tells us about his mindset and his personality, that he was deceptively trying, and just the leverage he was trying to take here with, but Jesus, could we not help the poor? What did he know about Jesus and the poor? He certainly knew Jesus cared a lot about them. They were his priority. He talked about them. And so he took advantage of this and said, we should sell this and give it to poor people. And I think Jesus' response to this is so interesting. Because you could say that it's a really hard thing for Jesus to say, no, let's not give it to the poor. Instead, rub it on my feet. It seems a little bit counterintuitive, doesn't it? That Jesus would say, no, give me more honor. Put this stuff on me and give me this honor. We don't need to give that to the poor. But let's turn over to Matthew 26 and see his explanation. Because I think Jesus' response to Judas here is enlightening. Now, of course, John, when he wrote this, he is in retrospect, he's able to say, no, Judas wanted to steal this money. So he had that in retrospect. Matthew, we won't read the whole thing, but I will say in verse, it looks as if maybe Judas was also stirring up the other disciples, that he was influencing them, because it says in verse 8, but the disciples were indignant when they saw this, and they said, why this waste? For this perfume could have been sold for a high price and the money given to the poor. And so this is a little different angle to it that says, why are we wasting this? This is a waste of good perfume to put it on you. Instead, it could be sold for the poor. And it says in verse 10, but Jesus, aware of this, said to them, why are you bothering the woman? For she has done a good deed for me. For you always have the poor with you, but you do not always have me. For when she poured this perfume on my body, she did it to prepare me for burial. Truly I say to you, wherever the gospel is preached in the whole world, that this what this woman has done will be told in memory of her. So Jesus' response here is just so interesting to me. That he, and you know, we've talked already in this class about when Jesus is tested and his answers are always perfect. He always has just the right response to convict the insincere question and to give teaching. And so his teaching here says, when they say, why are you wasting this? Why are you wasting this perfume? His response is, whatever. You know, I think he's almost like, you don't care about the money. Leave her alone. Just let her do this. She has done a good deed for me. And that little small statement to me is really the center of what he's saying. She's doing a good deed. Why are you punishing her for doing this good deed? And his explanation is, you always have the poor with you, but you don't always have me here. What does he mean by that? When he says, the poor will be with you always, but I will not always be with you. He's very close to dying. And so he's not going to be here with them, okay? But why does that change things? This is a unique opportunity. He's saying you can still take care of the poor next year. If you really care about the poor, if that's really important to you, then do it. You've got plenty of time to take care of the poor. I'm not here for very long. And Mary has seen this opportunity and is taking advantage of this opportunity and not wasting it. And it's I almost wish those words had been said. She's not wasting the opportunity to honor me. And in fact, he says, she did this to prepare me for burial. There are other versions that say slightly differently, but what they say is she's preparing me for my burial, almost like she's embalming him. I don't believe that she was saying that it was a direct correlation that she to his death, that her anointing him was some direct correlation. I think what he's saying is, I'm going to die soon. She's doing this so close to my death that it's almost like she's embalming me. Very soon, I will not be here anymore. And she has chosen this opportunity to do a good deed. So I feel like there's another side of this, which is the value of the simple good deed. Even though this was an extremely expensive one, he is pointing out the value of this good deed that she chose to do at this moment because it was a rare opportunity. And she decided she would take advantage of that. And I feel like almost we live in a time where we have lost the valuation of the simple good deeds because we live in a world where there are so many opportunities to do big things. With social media and the internet and broadcast media and the travel and the opportunities that we have to try to make home run type impacts sometimes I think woo us away from the opportunity to do simple good right here, right now, where we have opportunity. I have known people, and I probably have done it myself, who have ignored needs right here, ignored needs with people just right here in their presence, because they're trying to do something that has bigger splash, because they're trying to do something that has maybe gets more recognition or maybe has more visibility. Instead of saying, this person right here, no offense, this person right here needs something, and I'm going to take care of it right now because that's when the need is. If that's true, let me know. But that's the key, isn't it? That sometimes we ignore the need right here, right now. Maybe it's not flashy enough. Maybe it doesn't seem important enough. And we move on to other things. Same thing with evangelism, I think. Sometimes I think we ignore local community evangelism because we feel like we need to do world evangelism. And I think both are very important. Both must be done. But we can't do world evangelism to the detriment of our community evangelism. Take the opportunity that you have. So I hope that makes sense. It was really important to me, I think, to see Jesus' response. But his response to Judas Iscariot was, give me a break. Leave the girl alone. You don't care about the poor. Don't pretend like you care about the poor. I'm right here, right now, and I'm going to be gone soon. Take advantage of this. Before we move on, any other comments just about this scene where Judas is insincerely trying to take the money and Jesus reprimands him? Yes, please. You talk about knowing that he would be gone soon? I'm not sure. I think she did. I think she was honored that Jesus was there. And so it's possible that she maybe was doing this as a symbol, knowing he would die. Maybe that's what you're alluding to, that she was doing this as a symbol, knowing he would die soon. And so she was making a statement. That's possible. My angle on it is that Jesus was in her house and she was going to give him as much honor as she possibly could at that time. I don't know the answer, honestly. Yes, sir. Yeah, well, and they were close. And they were close, but clearly the disciples didn't know what was coming, and they did not. I mean, of course, even until it happened, they didn't know. Were you going to say something, Philip? Yeah, it's interesting. We're gonna see even more. Once again, I have the order of this. It's not for a couple pages, but let's just skip to it. You're ruining my whole track now. That's just Matthew 26. Just turn to Matthew 26 for Philip. Maybe you're already in Matthew 26, but when it talks about, we're going to skip ahead a little bit in verse 20. When evening came, Jesus was reclining at the table with the 12, and as they were eating, he said, "Truly I say to you, one of you will betray me." Being deeply grieved, they began saying to him, each one, "Surely it is not I, Lord." And he answered, "He who dipped his hand with me in the bowl is the one who will betray me. The Son of Man is going away, just as it is written about him. But woe to that man by whom the Son of God is betrayed. It would have been good for that man if he had not been born." And Judas, who was betraying him, said, "Surely it is not I, Rabbi." And Jesus said to him, "You have said it yourself." I bring this up like what Philip said. It took restraint in this moment, didn't it? Because he said, one of you is going to betray me. And they all are saying, no, not me, right? Lord, not me, not me. And then Judas comes up to him. Why is that ridiculous? We're going to find out he had already betrayed him. It had already happened, and now he comes and says, "Surely not I, Lord." And Jesus' response isn't to come down on him. It is, "You said it. You've said it yourself." It's almost like, you need to deal with this, Judas. Yes, please.
And
So she brought up a few things. She decided to move us even further forward in the process, which is fine. But she brought up one of the things. It was one of the things I want to ask about, and I'll mention what she said now, is I want to ask the question, what was his motive later on? So think about this. Why did Judas do this? And there are lots of thoughts out there about this. One she brought up is perhaps he didn't think they would go through with it. Perhaps she, you know, because he goes afterwards and almost seems surprised that, you know, when he goes to them and says, I betrayed innocent blood. I don't want to go much further with it because we're going to talk about that. But, you know, it's hard to know what was in his head, what he thought was going to happen. But when I mention this section is because he is, he's so evil that he has done it and still tries to treat Jesus like a friend. And calls him rabbi. Well, it's not I, rabbi, my teacher. Is it not I, even though it's already been done? And he says, Jesus just says, you have said it yourself. So we'll come back to there in just a moment. But let's I'm going to make sure I know where I'm at here. Let's continue on in Matthew 26 in verse 14. So let's go back a little ways. Because what I want to do is I want to make sure we get this timeline right. Because now we've just looked at this scene where he is reprimanding Mary for wasting this perfume. Jesus speaks with him about that. And there are some who argue that what happens next is a reaction to that. There are some that say, and I don't know, that this scene where Matthew writes that Jesus kind of speaks back to him and tells him, you know, the poor will be with you always, but I will not be with you. And where he says, you have just reprimanded Mary, but I will tell you that wherever the gospel is preached in the whole world, what this woman has done will also be told in memory of her. It is truly a recant to what he's saying. And the next thing we read in Matthew 26 is, then one of the 12, named Judas Iscariot, went to the chief priest and said, what are you willing to give me to betray him to you? And they set out for him 30 pieces of silver. And from then, he looked for a good opportunity to betray Jesus. This idea that he went to them. They weren't begging him. They weren't coming to him and saying, listen, you know, if you can give us information about Jesus, there's 30 pieces of silver in it for you. And trying to convince him. He went to them and said, how much will you give me for this? Mark 14, I'll just allude to these. You don't have to turn to those. But Mark 14, it says, then Judas Iscariot, who was one of the 12, went off to the chief priest in order to betray him to them. They were delighted when they heard this and promised to give him money. And he began seeking how to betray him in an opportune time. As soon as they offered him money, he started looking for the opportunity, trying to find when it could best be done. But the fact that he went to them and they were delighted, they thought, because what were they doing? What had they been doing this entire time? Yeah, their entire life's purpose was to find a way to trap Jesus and to take him down. And then a guy just walks in there and says, hey, I'm in his inner circle. How much will you give me to betray him? And it says they were delighted. In Luke 22, I want to look at this one too because it says something about Judas. And let's go ahead and turn to Luke 22 in verse 1. Now the feast of unleavened bread, which is called the Passover, was approaching, and the chief priests and the scribes were trying to find a way to put him to death, since they were afraid of the people. And Satan entered Judas, the one called Iscariot, who belonged to the number of the 12, and he left and discussed with the chief priests and officers how he was to betray him to them. And they were delighted and agreed to give him money. And so he consented and began looking for a good opportunity to betray him to them away from the crowd. So this is another account of him going there and saying, I'm willing to do this. And they just were pleased as punch. They thought, well, this is a great opportunity. And I have a feeling, based on what the offer was, when they said 30 pieces of silver and he accepted, I think their reaction was, oh, okay, great. Because 30 pieces of silver is worth about, I've seen anywhere from $100 to $300. Not much. And think about the scene before this where he was dealing with something worth $20,000. And now he is willing to betray Jesus for a couple hundred, $300. And we're going to talk more as we go along. I still want to keep talking about this, about why would Judas be willing to betray a man he called master for a couple hundred dollars? And we'll talk more about that as we go along. In John 13, it gives us another little angle about that. In John 13, it says, and this is right after the washing of the feet in John 13. Now, before the feast of the Passover, Jesus, knowing that his hour had come and that he would depart from this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. And during the supper, the devil, having already put into the heart of Judas Iscariot, the son of Simon, to betray him, Jesus, knowing that the Father had handed all things over to him, and that he had come forth from God and was going back to God, got up from the supper and laid his outer garments aside, and he took a towel and tied it around himself. And so that's one part of this section where it talks about that the devil had already put in the heart of Judas to betray him. We're going to talk about that more in a moment. But I do want to finish this section up where you see later on, remember what happens here. Jesus gets down to wash feet. I hope you remember, those of you who aren't off in Don's class, when he got down and started to wash feet, who spoke up? Peter spoke up and said, what? You're not going to wash my feet. Jesus said, but if I don't wash your feet, you can have no part of me. And Peter then replied, then wash all of me. You can wash all of me then. And Jesus says in verse 10, he who has bathed needs only to wash his feet. Otherwise, he is completely clean. And you are clean, but not all of you. For he knew the one who was betraying him. It was for this reason that he said, not all of you are clean. So Jesus is making this reference where when he's talking about them washing, he keeps on taking a little poke on it and saying, hey, y'all are clean, but not all of you are clean. Almost just like this side statement that probably made Judas's heart speed up a little bit. Or maybe I hope that these little things he was saying were causing reaction. But I want to talk just for a minute about the motive of Judas Iscariot. We just read two passages here, one of which said Satan entered Judas. And in this passage it says the devil having already put into the heart of Judas Iscariot to betray him. And I thought we should talk just for a little bit about this idea, about what does it mean that Satan entered his heart? What does it mean that the devil had put it in him? Because I have read lots of different angles on this. Some of them say he was possessed by the devil. There are some that say that it wasn't Judas doing this at all. The devil possessed him and that it was just the devil doing these things. I do not believe that. I have read that lots of different things. In fact, there are lots of them that make him look really good. Some of them try to. I was talking to my mother about it. She was reading up about there's a Gospel of Judas. And, you know, there are a lot of these Gospels that are out there. I think there's one of Andrew, of most of the apostles. And the Gospel of Judas is a hero story about how Judas facilitated the Savior's death and how, you know, if it wasn't for him, it would not have happened. But let me talk for a minute. What does it mean to you that Satan entered him or that the devil had put into him? Yes, sir? If you couldn't hear him, he decided to go all the way back to Genesis 1. So Genesis 1, the idea of Satan lying to Eve and putting the seed and putting that in and causing her to act before she considered the consequences, much like what Judas, when he didn't think it out. Yes, please. That's a way that I see it, that if you couldn't hear him very well, he said he's already decided. I wrote down, his mind was made up. When in John 13, I almost read it as his mind was made up. He was doing this. He was going to betray him. He had been thinking about it. He had been thinking about that sweet $300 that he was going to get out of it, and he was going to do it. when it talks about Satan entering Judas, and I want to talk, so next time, this is what I want to start with. What is it that was in his heart that caused him to do this? Was it hatred for Jesus? I don't think so. Was it that he was a serial murderer? Was he just a criminal? What is it that made him do that? We're going to say something, Ray?
I'm going to ask a question.
Oh, yes, please do.
Jesus chose 12. Peter, wonderful, impetuous young man, Andrew, James, John. When he got to Jesus, why did he choose?
So this is a good, don't take credit for this, but this is a good transition to next class. So all of you need to come back on Wednesday, I think, because this is kind of a cliffhanger here, I think. But Don will be fine. But that's a big question. In fact, let's start there. What was his motive? And then also, why did Jesus select him? And so a question has to be asked. I'm going to throw, these are just questions I'm throwing out. Did Jesus, I know he's capable of knowing, but did he already foresee what Judas was going to do when he picked him? Or was he going to, did he pick him with high hopes and Judas betrayed them? Here's the things I'll point out. The other disciples did not seem to know. When Jesus said, one of you will betray me, they didn't go, Judas, right? And I think sometimes if somebody said, one of the people here is going to do this, we would be like, yeah, Ron Adams. I mean, that guy's, you know he's the guy who's going to do it. Look at him. But you know, what's that? You're just glad it wasn't you that I mentioned. You know what I'm saying? That sometimes people will say, you know, was his reputation one of a betrayer, a traitor? Every time we see it about him, it says he became a traitor. He became a thief. And I don't know. And so let's talk about that a little bit. So the question that Ray asked, which we'll use as our transition, is what motivated Judas to do this? Why did he do this? What was in his heart? And why did Jesus allow it? Why did Jesus select him as one of his closest disciples, his inner circle, and make himself vulnerable? And this was the outcome, Jesus knowing that this was his potential. Thank you very much for your input tonight. We'll continue this next time. We'll talk to you again Wednesday.